Hey, podcast listeners, this is Anne Althaus, your podcaster, your blogger. It's been a few days since I've podcast, but I'm still blogging every day. You know, when I get the urge to podcast, I go back over all the blog posts I've been writing, and I try to see what I'm in the mood to talk about. And there's some posts that I'm just absolutely not in the mood to talk about. And I've got to tell you, even though I know a lot of my readers come to the blog because they want to read and talk about political candidates and what's the next thing about the last election or the next election, I find that so dreary. I don't feel like talking about that at all. You know, I've minimized how many posts I've written about all of the many challenges to the voting that Trump has been doing, Trump and his people, and obviously the Electoral College finally voted, and some people are finally getting their head around the idea that whatever went right or wrong at that point in the past, that day we called Election Day, it's not going to change what will happen next January, and that Joe Biden, if he survives long enough and doesn't withdraw, will be sworn in as the next president. And if not, it'll be Kamala Harris. I mean, I'm predicting that Kamala Harris will become the president by March 1st. I don't think it's really in the cards for Biden to keep going. I'm not saying I think he's going to pass on or that he's really too old to stumble along in the presidential pathway. I just think it's in the plan that he's going to lead. One thing that really annoyed me was that Time magazine, with its usual person of the year stunt, which I give the tag annual nonsense, they asked us on December 10th which of the four options that they had they were going to pick, like causing me to blog about this, which annoyed me when I found out what ultimately happened. They gave us a list of the four finalists, and one of the four finalists was Biden. Now, obviously too boring, that's not going to be it. Trump was another one, obviously not going to be it. Frontline healthcare workers and Dr. Anthony Fauci, I thought, obviously that's going to be it, because I thought that the frontline healthcare workers really should have gotten it, but were a little bit too like the, I think, frontline Ebola workers from maybe 2017, whatever that year was, not that long ago. I thought that made it a little hard to just give it to the frontline healthcare workers, but they also put Anthony Fauci in that finalist option, frontline healthcare workers and Dr. Anthony Fauci. So I thought that by grouping those two together, that was showing that's the one that's going to win. That's obviously going to be it. And I wrote the other item on the short list that is plausible is, and this was the fourth one. Remember, the first ones were Biden or Trump, and then frontline healthcare workers and Dr. Anthony Fauci grouped together. And then finally, movement for racial justice, as they put it. In the midst of a worldwide pandemic, protesters took to the streets demanding action to fight racial injustice at the hands of police and any entity that embodies systemic discrimination. I thought that was the second most likely. But as for the options that were just either Biden or Trump, not lumped together, I wrote this, not lumped together, but separate, no way. And then a couple of days later, they announced it. And I updated this post and said, how perfectly annoying. Time did not pick one of the four options on its own list that they suckered me into blogging about. The actual choice was Biden and Kamala Harris. But that wasn't what they had listed as the finalists. I had predicted they were going to pick one that had two things grouped together, frontline healthcare workers and Anthony Fauci, precisely because of the grouping together. And they didn't group Joe Biden with Trump or with Kamala Harris. But in the end, they gave it to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I was so annoyed. I mean, I really felt like, oh, I am never falling for this crap again. This, I call it annual nonsense. Why do I get suckered into it? they tried to make it more surprising when they were doing the most boring possible thing of picking just whoever wins the presidential election. Don't they almost always do that every 4 years, whoever wins the presidential election? Here they are getting ready to do it again. But they fake us out by making the option look too boring to pick, by making another option look almost inevitable by making a group, and then ultimately putting Biden in a group with Kamala Harris. Oh, I was so annoyed. I wrote another post just to say how annoyed I was and that I was suckered into this. And then maybe about a day after that, I wrote a post to say Times Person of the Year should have been the monolith. No, plywood. And that was on December 12th. I wrote that as something that I just said out loud. I was just saying Times Person of the Year should have been the monolith. And that was me expressing my attitude that, man, I'm so sick of this crap, this annual nonsense. And didn't everybody act for a moment as if the monolith were the most interesting thing in the world? I mean, it's nothing, and obviously it doesn't deserve anything. And I sort of think it's funny that the person of the year could be an object. Not that they haven't chosen a mere object as the person of the year before. And then I liked withdrawing even from that and deciding something more bleak, in a more bleak object that was very prominent in the past year, plywood. I still live in a city that has plywood on the windows downtown. They went up fairly early in the summer, I think, and they still haven't been able to get them down. The idea of why should we take them down? They'll just break our windows again. That expresses something about the terrible bleakness of the year. And yet for me personally, and one reason I said that out loud in my own home, was that last month we rented an Airbnb in Brown County, Indiana, so we could go hiking and mountain biking in Brown County State Park, which may be not the most famous state park to you, but it's in Indiana. So if you know Indiana, you might know this place. And we found an Airbnb, and it was a really cool modern house that we enjoyed spending some time in. And the inside of the house was raw plywood, and it looked great. It was just beautiful, seemed like perfect walls. And so it's all very subjective whether plywood is good or bad. Plywood on the windows downtown, horrible, bleak, depressing, expressing how we can't even take care of our own shops. We can't support our own shopkeepers. Everything will be broken. Destructive people are out and about. The worst. But in a house that was built that way, it seemed sleek and modern and cool and beautiful in the way that purely utilitarian things can be beautiful. We love that plywood. So, you know, it's all in the mind. It's all in the mind. What is the person of the year? Person of the year can be anything that you like, including objects. Have your own person of the year. Be your own person of the year. Who knows? Now, one of the most interesting things in the last few days was this Joseph Epstein column in the Wall Street Journal. Everybody talked about it, and I think my take on it was best. Sorry, people. Maybe I always think, we all always think that our own take is best. That's why it's our take. What do you think? Whatever you think, that must be what you think is best. Otherwise, why do you think it? Are you some sort of contrarian? Or maybe you only bother to think things that other people haven't thought yet, and all the best things have already been thought. Therefore, your thoughts aren't so great. But I maintain, and let me read this to you, that my position on Joseph Epstein's essay telling Jill Biden to put aside the Dr. Jill honorific is best. So let's take a close look, I wrote, at this Wall Street Journal article that's causing a mini uproar. Notice, mini uproar. That's like the monolith. People get all their panties in a twist about one thing one day, and it's the thing of the day, or maybe of the week, or of a couple of days, and then it goes away, it's almost nothing. And, you know, the Epstein mini uproar was yesterday. By the time you listen to this, it'll be even more distantly dissipated into the dustbin of the past. But the name of this Wall Street Journal op-ed was, "Is there a doctor in the White House?" Not if you need an MD. Joe Biden should think about dropping the honorific, which feels fraudulent, even comic. So this essay was by Joseph Epstein, who's 83 years old, and he's been an essayist for a long time. He's been writing essays and publishing collections of essays for many years. He knows how to do an essay. And I'm going to say, I say he really scored with this essay because he wrote something snippy and snappy that got everybody to pay attention and talk about something. He put something in issue. He made a thing happen. He made us talk about whether Dr. Jill Biden, should drop the doctor. Who calls themselves doctor? Whatever. If you're not a medical doctor, should you be doing that? Who does that? It's an interesting question. And of course, it brought these screams of rejection that he's a misogynist. How terrible. He's a misogynist telling this woman who works hard to get her doctorate degree. She wants to be called Dr. Jill. You know, lawyers have a JD, Juris Doctor degree. You're going to call every lawyer doctor? It's just diluting the idea of doctor. But I give him credit. He got this thing in issue in a pretty spiffy way. It really gave people with a need to write essays and mini essays, tweets and blog posts, something to write oh so easily about. I mean, he served up the issue just perfectly, and then everybody was able to talk about it. Isn't that what an essay is supposed to do? But why is he called a misogynist? Why are people calling him a misogynist? For calling bullshit on the use of doctor for people who are not medical doctors. At the point when I started writing this post, I hadn't read the essay yet and had only glanced at the criticism enough to see this charge of misogyny. And I said, what I'm going to presume is that it's perceived as misogynist because it's women and not men who style themselves as doctor when they're not medical doctors. Why do women do this? Are they guessing they'll be thought less of because they're female? The doctor business might be a defense against real or imagined misogyny, but that doesn't make it misogynistic to argue that it's time to lay off the self-puffery of the non-medical doctor. Okay, so then I started reading the essay. Quote, "Madam First Lady, Mrs. Biden, Jill, kiddo, a bit of advice on what may seem like a small but I think is not an unimportant matter. Any chance you might drop the doctor before your name?" Close quote. And I said, he's just asking. The kiddo might seem overfamiliar, but it's in a series from most formal to most familiar, laying out a series of approaches to addressing the woman, Madam First Lady, Mrs. Biden, Jill, kiddo, is a way to say, what should I call you? He's asking. Quote, Dr. Jill Biden sounds and feels fraudulent, not to say a touch comic, close quote. And I said, that's phrased with some politeness, jocose politeness, but he's plainly saying it is fraudulent and comical. All right, he's got us, and those with an inclination to protect the Bidens are activated and ready to denounce old man Epstein. As a person of cruel neutrality, I am anticipating liking this essay. I'm thinking this doctor bullshit among women has gone on too long and is a marker of inferiority. So he's calling on Jill Biden to set a good example and drop the honorific. You don't need it and you shouldn't want it. I mean, think about this, marker of inferiority. Why am I saying that? I think it's like flaunting your credentials. If you really believed in yourself, If you really thought yourself fully respected, you wouldn't need to beg for that kind of respect. It looks needy. It looks like you are afraid of being considered inferior. Now, women do actually face that risk, and I understand the defensiveness. But to say, look, you don't need it, is to say, we respect you. Women aren't inferior. Women don't have to be bonking us on the head in a formal way with their titles to try to get respect. You have respect because you are worthy. And aren't we all worthy? Yeah, I mean, why say you're worthier than someone else? Why don't we all deserve respect? Why don't we all have the same honorific, or just forget all the honorifics? He said, your degree is, I believe, an ED, an EdD, a Doctor of Education, earned at the University of Delaware through a dissertation with the unpromising title, Student Retention at the Community College Level, Meeting Students' Needs. And I said, unpromising? That's mean. He's denouncing her dissertation without reading it, and yet it's a bit convincing. He's saying, come on, you didn't do any serious scholarship, did you? And there's a lot in the article. I didn't reprint all the quotes from the article, but there's a lot in the article about how hard it used to be to get a PhD, the layers of testing and the difficulty, and that it really meant something in a way that it doesn't really today. Quote from Epstein, a wise man once said that no one should call himself doctor unless he has delivered a child. Think about it, Dr. Jill, and forthwith drop the doc. Now, some people have pointed out, and this is, I think, the best feminist point that was made, that, you know, she gave birth to a child as a woman. So hasn't she delivered a child? What does it mean? Do you deliver a child when you're the pregnant person who goes through childbirth? Is that delivering a child? So that was an awkward phrasing by Mr. Epstein. Quote, think about it, Dr. Jill, and forthwith drop the doc. You can see he's trying to be humorous. Forthwith, that's using an old-timey locution. Forthwith, drop the doc. So drop the doc sounds like modern-day slang, or at least what to an 83-year-old man would seem like modern-day slang, and putting the old-fashioned with the modern together like that is obviously making quite a show of being comical. I'm not saying it's terribly comical. I'm just saying it is a display of the writer's intent to be considered comical. Forthwith, drop the doc. He goes on, I taught at Northwestern University for 30 years without a doctorate or any advanced degree. So he didn't have any advanced degree. That's interesting to be able to teach at a university with no doctorate or any advanced degree. Epstein is justly proud of how well he's done without a doctorate. He's in a good position to look down on people whose big point of pride is their degree. Show me what you've done, with or without the degree. That's why you get a degree, isn't it? To do something with what you've learned, not to flaunt the degree per se. I kind of like that somebody is proud of all they did without a degree. Let's see what you've done. Once you're old, and of course Epstein's 83 and Joe Biden is over 70, the question is, what have you done? Now, you're not applying for the job. You're not straight out of school. So who cares about your degree? What'd you do? The higher degree you got, the more you ought to have to show for yourself because of it. And you shouldn't be back there saying, hey, look at my degree. You should be, well, we should already know of your achievements. What did you achieve? Are we looking at you? If you want to say, well, I didn't achieve that much because I'm female and I was discriminated against, well, then let's hear about that. But if the main thing you have to show for yourself is, I have a doctorate, and you're in your 70s, what the hell is that? Back to Epstein. Quote, in contemporary universities in the social sciences and humanities, calling oneself doctor is thought bush league. The PhD may have once held prestige, but that has been diminished by the erosion of seriousness and the relaxation of standards in university education generally, at any rate, outside the sciences. Dr. Jill, I note you acquired your ED, EdD, as recently as 15 years ago, at age 55, long after the terror of examinations had departed. Forget the small thrill of being Dr. Jill. The small thrill of being Dr. Jill. And settle for the larger thrill of living the next 4 years in the best public housing in the world as First Lady Jill Biden. Now, let me say that he's swapping one title for another, and we want if he's saying we want to call you First Lady Jill Biden as opposed to calling you Dr. Jill, if you're going to pick between those two titles, please let us call you First Lady Jill Biden, Jill Biden, because didn't we say First Lady Michelle Obama or First Lady Melania Trump, First Lady Laura Bush? Isn't that the way we talk? So shouldn't we say that about you while you're trying to shift us into Dr. Jill? It's like you're not so proud of First Lady, but maybe there's kind of a feminist point there, which is you're calling, if you say First Lady Jill Biden, you're referring to her based on the status of her husband. But First Lady really does have a lot of responsibilities, and presumably she's going to take them on, unless she's not. If she's not going to do that work and step into that role, then maybe staying Dr. Jill is a way of saying, I'm keeping my independence. That's what's important. It's not so much that I deserve to be called a doctor because I have an ed doctor, E-ed-D. It's that I want to make it prominent that I'm operating independently and I'm going on my own career, and not the role of First Lady. That might be a little disrespectful to the other First Ladies who have had, certainly Michelle Obama had her own career, but so did Laura Bush. She was a librarian. What about Hillary Clinton? She was a lawyer and a law professor. We called her First Lady Hillary Clinton. Melania Trump was a model. Melania Trump had her line of, didn't she have a jewelry business or some certain businesses of hers? But she went under the title First Lady Melania Trump. So isn't to say I want to be called Dr. Jill because I don't want to be labeled based on my husband's job, then retrospectively, what does that say about all those other First Ladies? Anyway, First Lady is a job. It's a high position. There's only one person with it. Shouldn't we be saying that? And don't we want to say that about the husband of the first woman president? First man, first gentleman, aren't we going to want to use that title? If we ditch the first lady title right before the first woman president comes in, then that could be a reason for the first gentleman to not call himself first gentleman. Or maybe that's the idea. Maybe Dr. Jill and Doug, whatever his last name is, Emhoff or something, Kamala Harris's husband, maybe they're colluding, and the idea is he doesn't want to be called first gentleman. He wants to just continue doing what he does as his career and have that be respected. Kind of reminds me of Prince Philip in The Crown. I've been watching that. Boy, Prince Philip did not, at least as the story is told in The Crown, didn't really want to be considered consort of the Queen as just the attachment to the Queen. He wanted to have his own career and have that be what's recognized. So maybe there's some of that. Anyway, I'm seeing some new dimensions to this that I didn't see when I wrote the post. And I go on to say, I've deleted some of the text, but there's nothing in it that goes after women in particular. It's not misogynistic at all. Misogynistic means woman-hating. It doesn't mean didn't think of all the feminist angles, or I didn't analyze the aspects of the problems that women may have. It should mean that you actually hate women, that you're bigoted against women. It's not misogynistic. And I think Epstein is right to advise non-physicians to eschew the doctor honorific. He could be criticized for not showing any concern for how women in particular have used this mode of demanding respect and dignity. But in a way, he's showing respect by talking to Jill Biden the way he'd talk to a man. It's ridiculous. Cut the crap. And then I amended to say, here's my idea. Limit doctor as a form of address to the people who are inviting those who talk with them to use doctor kind of like a first name. You know, you go to your medical doctor and you say, Doctor, look at this, I have this rash here. Could you look at this, doctor? It gives you a kind of familiarity while still having the professional relationship there's some status involved there, but it lets you talk to the person with the equivalent of a first name. And I'm saying that because as a law professor, that's how it worked for me. I didn't want students to call me Anne, but they could call me Professor, like it was my first name. They didn't have to say Professor Althaus or Ms. Althaus. And then they didn't need to think, well, should I say Anne? It seems kind of casual. They could say Professor, and Professor kind of worked like a first name. And then somebody emailed me, somebody at Stanford, someone who teaches at Stanford emailed, when I first started teaching at Stanford, someone remarked to me that he had never met a physicist who used doctor and never met a PhD from the education school who did not. This held true in my experience for decades now. So that's saying in the departments where getting a PhD is really difficult, notably physics, they don't use doctor. They don't go around calling each other Dr. Smith and Dr. Jones. But in the education department, which the implication is that it's less rigorous than physics, tell me I'm wrong, but it's a sense of inferiority of the people who have their degree from that place that they want to say, call me doctor. I worked hard for that title, but you didn't work that hard. You really didn't work that hard. And why do you want this distinction of as being the person who worked harder than other people who don't have that degree? It's not that impressive of a degree, and your need to wave it in our face seems to come from a position of inferiority. And it is something that women do, I think, more than men, or people want to do it for women, like doing women an extra favor, a courtesy. It's kind of like the opening of the doors for the woman or the putting women on a pedestal. It's not really, is that really what you want? It's not equality. Now, way back on December 8th, it was the 40th anniversary of the death of John Lennon. And I don't really, speaking of annual nonsense, one thing that comes up every year, I don't want to really call this nonsense because it's pretty serious, the remembering of a murder. I'd rather remember a great person that I cared about on their birthday, not on their death day. We celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday. We don't go by the death day. But negative days are remembered during the year. Pearl Harbor Day, September 11th, the death of Kennedy, John Kennedy. But even other dates, but murder, I don't think a murderer deserves the recognition that he's getting. John Lennon's murderer is still alive, still able to read how we talk about him every year. But the 40th anniversary, I guess, that's a pretty big deal. My son John was born shortly after John Lennon died. John Lennon died on December 8th, 1980, and then I was pregnant then. And my son John was born on St. Patrick's Day of 81, March 17th. And the decision to name him John was related to that. And my son John had put up a memorialization of John Lennon on his blog. So I wanted to link to that. But what it caused me to do was to go back and look at, well, he linked to a post that I had written in 2005. So that was 15 years ago. That was the 25th anniversary of John Lennon's death. Yeah. Man, I've been blogging that long, 15 years ago. Yeah, it was only 25 years after John Lennon had died. That seemed like a long time. But boy, 40 years. Seems like 15 shouldn't make that much more. I have to stop and think, is it really true that 25 and 15 make 40? But yeah, that's true. And in 15 years, my son went from being 25 to 40. Isn't that a shocking fact of math? Well, this shows that my advanced degree was not in mathematics, because I'm still amazed by addition. Anyway, John, in his blog post about the 40-year anniversary of the murder of John Lennon, linked to the post that I had written on the 25th anniversary of the death in 2005. And I looked back at that post. It was very interesting to read it again, because it brought up something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, not in connection with John Lennon, but sometimes when I'm out running, I get onto some line of thought, and I'll think about maybe a book I could write, like a memoir, a sequence of my own life, and how, or making it into a novel, how I could explore something, and sometimes think about alternate paths that I could have taken. Something about being out running along a trail makes you think about paths that your life might have gone on. So back in 2005, I wrote, "On the day I heard that John had died, I was a law student at NYU. I remember dragging myself into the law review office and expecting everyone there to be crying and talking about it, but no one was saying anything at all. I was insecure enough to feel that I was being childish to be so caught up in the story of the death of a celebrity long past his prime. I didn't even take the train uptown to go stand in the crowd that I knew had gathered outside the Dakota. What did I do? I can't remember. I probably buried myself in work on a law review article. How I regret not going uptown to be among the people who openly mourned John Lennon. How foolish I was to think that I was foolish to care and to put my effort into blending in with the law review editors who I imagined were behaving in a way I needed to learn." And I wrote, looking back at that reaction, so I wrote on the 8th of this year, looking back on the 2005 post, I realized I was influenced by the shame that I'd felt in 1977 when I showed my feelings about the death of Elvis Presley. Did I ever blog about that? It's something I've thought about lately, you know, when I've been out running and thinking about my life and maybe writing one of my unwritten books in my head, the story of my life or the alternate version of my life. And it turns out I did blog about that also in 2005. In August of 2005, I wrote, 28 years ago, Elvis died. August 16th isn't a date I keep in my head, but I was driving in my car listening to the 50s channel, and they were playing Elvis's Sun recordings and saying, it's been 28 years. They played Mystery Train, very beautiful, on a summer night. I got to thinking about that night 28 years ago. I'd gone to bed early and was listening to the radio and heard that Elvis had died. I got up and got dressed and came out into the living room to say, Elvis died. They looked at me like they thought I was stupid and said, who cares? Who cares? Like that. Who cares? Who cares? Like, what are you doing? What, you got up to come out and tell us Elvis died? What's your problem? And I said, this year, writing about that, I wrote, I didn't question their reaction, but only felt ashamed of my own. I accepted their imputation that I was unsophisticated and immature. And a few years later, I developed a stoical exterior and kept quiet about the death of a person I cared far more about, and who had died, unlike Elvis, with shocking suddenness, murdered, and not after a long, sad decline. These days, shuffling through my memories, I sometimes sink into a deep meditation about that night I heard that Elvis died. I think about how different it would have been if I'd believed in myself and the version of reality where people care that Elvis died. If I'd believed and acted on my convictions, I don't think I'd have gone to law school at all, let alone endured the loneliness of grieving over John Lennon around people who were either grieving only internally or who would have sneered, who cares, just like my Elvis interlocutors. So sometimes this visualization of if only I believed in myself the night Elvis died really got into my thoughts as I was out running. I felt like I wanted to write a novel about me, the person who packed my bags and went out on my own because I don't belong here. I don't belong with people who say, who cares about Elvis dying? Elvis dying mattered. And my caring about it and thinking other people, I want to be among people who would care when they heard that Elvis died. And I want to be among the people who would if they were in New York City the day, the morning after John Lennon was murdered at the Dakota, would go up there and stand in the crowd and be with the people who cared. Why wasn't I that person? I wanted to write a book just to create an alternative reality in which I was the person who would set out to find a place where I belonged instead of knuckling under and trying to endure the place where I already was and to become like those people who didn't care. Now, I think a lot of people care way too much about pop stars and celebrities. So I'm not saying I want to be in a milieu where it's all about the celebrities and people are just, that seems, I don't want to say shallow, because obviously I'm railing against people who made me feel bad for feeling that I was shallow, and I now think that it wasn't shallow. But I think at some point, caring about celebrities is shallow. Who knows? Speaking of things that are subjective, that's one of them. But, you know, so I guess everyone personally is entitled to decide at what depth they want to live on. I mean, you could be completely immersed in religion or philosophy or one of the really deep things and devote your whole life to it. You can be super deep. It's not necessarily the best choice. It's not really bad or good. It's your choice. You can choose to be a completely superficial person about the surfaces. Surfaces matter too. Surfaces could be great. You could be about, I used to be a painter. What is a painter but someone applying paint to surfaces? Those are surfaces. They could be great surfaces. Well, I would just say, I was talking about, what do you have to show for yourself? What have you done? What are you doing? What are your achievements? Pick a level, pick a depth, and do something there. How good is what you've done at the level that you've chosen? What's the point of going deep and doing nothing worthwhile at the deep level? Better to be a genius at the surface level. You could be any of those things. Make your choice, go where it seems right for you. You don't have to be at the depth level that other people are at. What if people were contemptuous of you for not devoting all your time to thinking about God or philosophy? You don't deserve that. You don't have to be contemptuous of them, but who are they to be contemptuous of you? You're not doing anything wrong. You're choosing where to be in your particular life. And if you choose to be somewhat superficial, and commit to it and do it well, I think, and this is a semi-deep thought, that's fine. That is deep in its own way. You can be deep superficial or superficial deep. Which is better? Deep superficial, right? Let's see. Where did I want to go from there? I wanted to talk about, I'm reading this book that I particularly like that is a collection of quotes. It's called Garner's Quotations, A Modern Miscellany. And, people know that I have a thing about the word garner. I just think it's ridiculous to say garner when you could say get or collect or one of the more normal words. And I got into the thing of making fun of the word garner when Jeb Bush, as he was running for the Republican nomination in 2016, he said garner too much. And it became a running joke around here that he just couldn't speak in normal the way ordinary people speak. What was the point of doing this? It's sort of like going around with doctor as your honorific. It's like you seem like you're overachieving, like you have an inferiority complex, and you can't just say, I need to get votes. You have to say, I need to garner votes. It's absurd. So that's just something I've been following, just like I've been following. There's some other words I'm interested in, but that's a particular word of mine. It's my personal bugaboo. But if your name is Garner, like Jennifer Garner or James Garner, or in this case, Dwight Garner, I have no problem with that. Garner's perfectly fine as a name. Anyway, he's a New York Times book critic for the nonfiction books. And he puts the quotes in a sequence that follows in a way subtly from subject to subject. You might have to stop and think about, well, why did that come after that? So they're certainly not in alphabetical order by author, and they're not under big headings like politics, religion, art, happiness, death. He didn't do that. It's subtler. You have to find where the thread is for yourself. So that's a little activity that you can do as you read this book. I highly recommend this book. So I picked out some of the quotes that I especially liked, and I put two of them in the title, and you could probably figure out that I chose these for the title because they related to my own personal experience writing a blog, being a blogger. Kingsley Amis, the comic writer, said, if you can't annoy somebody, there's little point in writing. Now, doesn't that relate to the Epstein quote, the Joseph Epstein column about Dr. Jill? If you can't annoy somebody, there's little point in writing. Well, he annoyed a whole hell of a lot of people, so that's why I said he scored with that op-ed. And, you know, in some ways, I don't like to bother anybody, I do think you have to have the nerve to annoy, and you have to, you know, have the energy in your writing enough that it's going to bother people. You want to do that. You can call that trolling, if you can't annoy somebody, there's little point in writing. And then I put that along with a second quote. This one is from Jean Cocteau, the wonderful French filmmaker and artist. Whatever they criticize you for, intensify it. Whatever they criticize you for, intensify it. That's something maybe Donald Trump follows. What do you think? Who are the people who really follow that? Whatever they criticize you for, intensify it. Yeah, that's where you know you've hit a nerve, that you're getting somewhere. Ah, now we're getting somewhere. You're getting criticized. More of that. Here are a few more. This one is from William S. Burroughs. I don't care if people hate my guts. I assume most of them do. The important question is whether they are in a position to do anything about it. And W.H. Auden said, thank God for books as an alternative to conversation. It's kind of an introvert's statement, isn't it? But, you know, I love great conversations. Great conversations are maybe the best thing ever. But you can't always get the people you need to have a great conversation. And bad conversations are boring and take up way too much time. Whereas books, as an alternative, you can kind of assure that you're going to get good material. Not quite as good as the best conversation, but if it's a good book and you get to choose or throw it aside if it isn't good, it's a good alternative. H.P. Lovecraft said, almost nobody dances sober unless they happen to be insane. Colson Whitehead, in A Psychotronic Childhood, wrote, a monster is a person who has stopped pretending. And Raymond Chandler wrote, when I split an infinitive, goddammit, I split it so it will stay split. You know, I don't like editors either. You know, it's not that, don't correct that. I did it for a reason. Don't undo it. Don't undo what I've done. Fran Lebowitz in the New York Times wrote, "If you removed all of the homosexuals and homosexual influence from what is generally regarded as an If you removed all of the homosexuals and homosexual influence from what is generally regarded as American culture, you would be pretty much left with, let's make a deal." And Gary Snyder, the poet, said, "Don't own anything you wouldn't leave out in the rain." I think that's a particularly beautiful one. Don't own anything you wouldn't leave out in the rain. And then I'll end with the Samuel Beckett here. "All I want to do is sit on my ass and fart and think of Dante." Seems a little bit like W.H. Arden with his books as an alternative to conversation. Do you think that maybe one of the reasons W.H. Auden liked books as an alternative to conversation is so he could sit on his ass and fart? Because when you're around other people, that really, that's kind of frowned on. Now, I see that Obama is out and about writing his book. Oh, where did I put that? Yes. This was in the New York Times. "Obama, the best-selling author on reading, writing, and radical empathy. He invited authors and historians to the White House and has already published a best-selling memoir. That didn't make writing his latest book, A Promised Land, any less of a grind." Sorry, we're already talking about writing, and this is going to be the subject going on until the end of the podcast. I think promise that. But, you know, there was all of this various chit-chat in this interview the New York Times did for Obama. And I kind of homed in on the stuff that was very practical about the mechanics of writing. Quote, "Because he thinks the computer can lend half-baked thoughts the mask of tidiness, he writes his first drafts longhand on yellow legal pads. The act of typing it into the computer essentially becomes a first edit. He says he's very particular about his pens, always using black Uniball Vision Elite rollerball pens with a micro point, and adds that he tends to do his best writing between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. I find that the world narrows, and that is good for my imagination. It's almost as if there is a darkness all around, and there's a metaphorical beam of light down on the desk, onto the page." This makes it sound rather mystical and monkish, isn't it? But this is like that, what I was just talking about deep and shallow, narrow and wide. He's saying he likes to get it so that the world narrows. The narrowing is good for his imagination. It's like saying shallow and deep, narrow and wide. I want it to narrow. And there's a certain time of night when I feel that that's happening. Now, let's see. I'm now down to the point where I want to talk about a book that I read, and I, at some point in this discussion, as I go in for the final approach to the ending of this podcast, I'm going to get to a point where I'm going to do a spoiler alert, and then I'm going to talk about something that's the ending of the book, so you just turn off when you get to that point if you don't want the spoiler. So I have two posts about, I have two posts about this book, and let me do the first one. The first one doesn't require a spoiler. I wrote it before I finished the book, so I won't give away the ending because I didn't know what it was. The novel is called Earthlings. And it's by a Japanese woman, Sayaka Murata. And I quoted from a review of the book in Literary Hub that was written 3 years ago when, this is about the author, and this was a review of her earlier book, Convenience Store Woman, which I thought was great. And I went back and read this old review about her because I was reading her new book, which is called Earthlings. I wanted to read about her, but I didn't want to read any spoilers at that point. So I read a review of her earlier book, which I've already read and which I liked a lot. It's literally about a woman that works in a convenience store. And this writer herself, Sayaka Murata, worked in a convenience store in Japan and liked it, liked the activity and the order and routine of working in a convenience store. And the author really did that while she was writing. She had her day job working in a convenience store and wrote about it. Anyway, from this old review, it says, and this the I here is the writer of the review, "I think the riskiest kind of novel is the one that tries to rescue us from mundane existence by taking a closer look at mundane existence." This doesn't that seem to fit with this theme of deep and shallow, right? So you might be deep by looking at the shallowness, looking deeply at the shallowness. The riskiest kind of novel is the one that tries to rescue us from mundane existence by taking a closer look at mundane existence. If the tone falls flat, then the action is simply a series of discrete encounters recreated on the page. In the best of these novels, from the work of Haruki Murakami to Albert Camus, the writer finds a tiny gap between the simple nature of things and how they appear to us. I thought that was an interesting thing about writing. And I was reading that because I was interested in Earthlings, and then I put a little quote. Here's a little quote that I put up at that point from Earthlings. "Deep down, everyone hates work and sex, you know. They're just hypnotized into thinking that they're great. My husband was always saying that. His parents, his brother, and his wife, and his friends sometimes came to spy on us. My husband's womb and testes were quietly kept under observation by the factory. Anyone who didn't manufacture new life or wasn't obviously trying to came under gentle pressure. Couples that hadn't manufactured new life had to demonstrate their contribution to the factory through work. My husband and I were living quietly in a corner of the factory, keeping our heads down." And that idea of the factory was the first person character regarded her town as a factory for the production of babies. So, what if you're married, but you're not trying to have a baby? What if you're not having sex? She and her husband got together to kind of hide from their families that they didn't want to be part of this factory, this production of babies. So, from the outside, it looked like they were trying to do their part and be part of the factory. But in reality, they were together exactly for the opposite reason. They didn't want to do that. Anyway, after I finished the book on December 10th, I wrote, quoting from an article in The Guardian that is titled Sayaka Murata, I acted how I thought a cute woman should act. It was horrible. And this is a quote from that article in The Guardian. Quote, "In her teens and 20s, she tried embracing conventional notions of womanhood just to avoid what she calls social harassment before abandoning it in disgust. I pretended to act the way I thought a cute woman should act, with an excess of femininity, but it was a horrible experience. I felt like I'd lost my will," she says. In a relationship with a convenience store manager 15 years her senior, she found she was expected to cook morning and evening and do his washing. It felt like being physically and mentally exploited. I mean, I hate food and cooking. I keep a vase on top of my cooker," she says, laughing. Murata says she starts with her characters and doesn't know the ending of her novels until she writes them. That might explain why Earthlings turns from whimsy to surrealist horror. And I said, I've finished the book now, so I'd like to discuss the ending. I'll put the spoilers, which are extreme, after the jump. You don't have to leave yet. I'll tell you when you need to stop. I'll be clear about this. So don't worry. There's a few more minutes before I say stop to avoid the spoiler. Quote. This is a quote from the Guardian article. Its final acts put the three main characters, Natsuki, her first love, Yu, and her fake... Boy, it's weird listening to a book. I read it through audiobook. It's weird listening to a book where there's a character named Yu. It's spelled Y-U-U, so if you're reading it visually, you won't get mixed up. But hearing the word Yu continually, with as if it's a third-person subject, which it is, it's a little strange. I got used to it. Anyway, its final act puts the three main characters, Natsuki, her first love, Yu, and her fake husband together in the mountainous Nagano countryside, where their rejection of the factory, society as it is, becomes complete. Convinced they are aliens at war. Oh, I should have put the spoiler alert there. Oh no, I didn't put the spoiler alert in the right place. Oh, I'm so sorry. Later I put stop here to avoid a big spoiler. Oh no, I've already ruined it for some of you. Anyway, all right, I'll do it right in the podcast. Stop listening now. I'm gonna have to say goodbye to you folks who care about the spoiler to the novel Earthlings. Oh, I can't believe I did this. I feel bad about this. Oh, well, anyway, I need to say goodbye to those of you who don't want to hear the spoiler to the Maratha novel, Earthlings. Okay? You gone now? Okay, so the only people who are left have already read the novel, Earthlings, or don't care about hearing the spoiler. Maybe the spoiler will make you want to read it. Okay, here goes. Wait, where was this point? Convinced they are aliens at war with the factory's emissaries, they resort to murder and cannibalism. That's the spoiler. Munching on an earthling. See, they thought they were aliens, so they would call other people earthlings. Of course, they were all human beings, but they got themselves into this frame of mind where they decided that they were aliens, and then they could kill and eat human beings, just like we would kill and eat animals, non-human animals. They were aliens. So, munching on an earthling, Natsuki finally recovers the sense of taste she lost as a result of the sexual abuse by a teacher that she experienced. That's described very vividly in the book, so that's another reason you might want to avoid reading the book. I felt as though I was eating for the first time in 23 years. Murata said she didn't set out to write a shocking book, but her subconscious invaded the pages. The people who know me through convenience store woman are disappointed, but I was a cult writer before that success. People are saying the old Murata has returned. And I said, convenience store woman was apparently the story of Murata's own life. From the Guardian article, quote, until recently, Sayaka Murata worked in a convenience store. I was so used to the rhythm of working that I found it hard to hang around all day writing. Japan's 55,000 nearly identical convenience stores are considered stopgap employers for job hoppers, students, housewives, and immigrants. All losers, says one of the characters in Convenience Store Woman contemptuously. But the main character in the novel, who is 36, a virgin, and uninterested in the bourgeois lives of her married peers, excels at the pliant robotic service demanded by the industry's manuals. So unsettled is she by invasive questions about her lack of a husband and children that she takes in a lazy, abusive lodger just to deflect them. Murata is also single and returns home in the evenings to her laptop and menagerie of what she calls imaginary friends. She, too, struggled to meet her family's expectations. Growing up in a conservative home outside Tokyo, her father was a district court judge, lonely and terribly shy. And I said, in Earthlings, the fake husband is someone the character found through a website called Surinuki.com. And Google Translate tells me that Surinuki means sliding through. This is from the text of the novel. As the name suggested, this was a site where people seeking to evade society's gaze for some reason, such as marriage, suicide, or deaths, could appeal for information or find collaborators. I went to the marriage page and checked the category for no sex, no children, registered marriage, to search for a partner. And this is the text of the ad she responded to. 30-year-old male, Tokyo resident, urgently seeks marriage partner to escape family surveillance. Business-like arrangement with all housework shared, separate finances, and separate bedrooms preferred. Absolutely no sexual activity, and preferably no physical contact beyond a handshake. Someone who refrains from showing bare skin in shared spaces preferred. And the novel goes on to say, quite a few men checked the box for no sex, but this one had caught my eye for having stipulated especially detailed rules. I'd be marrying a complete stranger on the verbal promise of no sex, so the less anxiety a potential partner provoked in me, the better. I immediately sent him a message, and after meeting two or three times in a cafe, we came to a mutual agreement and tied the knot. And I said, would you call that a fake husband? The guardian said that was a fake husband, but they really did legally get married. You've done the legal formalities, but the law may make this arrangement subject to annulment. Anyway, the legal question is the least interesting part of this. What's most interesting is the preference for locking in freedom from sex and the need to do this in a partnership because of the social and family pressure. I see an article from 4 years ago in Japan Times. In sexless Japan, almost half of single young men and women are virgins, according to a survey. And from last year in Japan Powered, Japan, the sexless society, quote, sexless relationships become a problem when it isn't a mutual agreement between the people in the relationship. People are choosing not to have sex for their own reasons. And I said, now, here's where I put the spoiler in the blog post. And then I said, here's a sample of the horror humor as the three main characters are cannibalizing their two murder victims. It's a meal of earthling, that is, human beings. The characters themselves have decided they are aliens. One of the three characters volunteers. Well, so this is an additional point. I'm going to defend my own putting the spoiler here. It's not just that they resort to cannibalism. There's something more than that, which I'm about to say, and I have not said yet. One of the three characters volunteers his own body as the next source of food for the group. A complication is that they've made a vow to each other, a vow that is the opposite of a marriage vow. Quote, we swore to live as completely separate entities from each other, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, that we would not love, cherish, or worship, nor stand by each other, and would live life for ourselves as long as we live. And I said, living this vow, they've been analyzing whether whatever they do is rational from a non-earthling point of view. The rational thinking becomes outrageous, and you'll like the book more if you think that if you think this is really funny, you'll like the book. That is, you have to like the sort of deadpan humor presentation of this. And I noticed that there was kind of a pun to saying deadpan because there's literally, in this part I'm about to read, some dead human meat frying in a pan. So, deadpan. Anyway, so they're doing this rationality. They have this, it's kind of a spoof of rationality. So they're going to live only for themselves and they're going to analyze whatever they do as in terms of whether it's rational from this non-earthling point of view, this alien point of view. So they're taking a new way of looking at life and they're calling this rationality. Now I'm going to just read this last paragraph, which, as I said, if you think this is really funny, then you would really like the book. And chances are, I don't think most people would find this funny. Anyway, this is the last thing I'm going to say in the podcast. It's a quote from the book. It's intended to be funny, and they're in the middle of cooking some dead human meat from one of their victims. He gently slid the spilled earthling stir fry back onto my husband's plate and said, "You're right, we did make the pledge. Well, how about this? How about we all taste a little bit of each other and then decide to eat each other in the order of how good we taste? If something is unpalatable, we probably wouldn't be able to finish eating it, and there's no need to cut off a finger or whatever in order to taste each other. We can just take a nibble." "Yes, that's fair. I think that's very rational," I agreed. My husband appeared satisfied with this suggestion. "Okay, yes, that's the best. If I taste the best, be sure to eat me up, all up, okay? First of all, my husband and I took a bite out of you, me from his shoulder, and my husband from his arm, testing the flavor on our tongues. He tasted slightly salty." And that's the end of the quote. I would note that if you really were going to do cannibalism like this, wouldn't you cook the meat? If you're really going to do a taste test, there's no cooking involved. So they were cooking their murder victims, but they were just raw eating each other as they taste tested to see what was good. Anyway, do you think that's funny? I think it's funny to analyze rationality and to take a strange view of reason and to make a sort of charmingly bad logical argument. But might not be charming to you because you have these people in this grisly eating each other kind of a scene. I've seen that in some other things. Someone mentions the movie Eating Raoul in the comments. Cannibalism can be an amusing thing. And, you know, you can go back to the Jonathan Swift essay, A Modest Proposal. That involves a proposal to eat babies as a solution to hunger. That's considered a classic essay. You know, to go back to our Joseph Epstein topics of essays and to go back to the Kingsley Amis idea of what's the point of writing unless you can annoy people, all of that. I think these things more or less fit together, don't you?